Chapter 3. It was indeed the prayed-for blow, with the wind backing and strengthening until on the third day it reached the east-northeast, where it blew a hard gale for 2 watches on end without varying a single point. But then, with the surprise under a close-reefed foresail and mizzen storm staysail, it began to veer and haul in a most confusing manner and with even greater force. At this point, well on in the graveyard watch, past 3 in the morning and with rain sweeping in almost solid sheets across the deck, Tom Pullings left his cot, put on his oilskins, and crept up the ladder to see how Davidge was weathering it. Most of the watch were in the waist, sheltering from the worst of the spray, rain, and flying water under the break of the forecastle, but the 4 men at the wheel and the officer standing behind them with 1 arm round the mizzenmast had the full choking sweep, and they kept their heads down to be able to breathe. Davidge was an experienced, capable seaman, and he had known some monstrous seas in his time, yet even so he answered Pulling's inquiry, roared with cupped hands into his ear with, "Pretty well, sir, I thank you, but I was thinking of calling the captain. Every time she comes up a trifle, the helm gives a kind of judder, as though the tiller ropes were either slipping on the barrel or growing frayed." Pullings shoved in among the men at the wheel, all of them Shelmerstonians as it happened, gripped the spokes, waited for her to come up after a heavy sea had knocked her head to leeward, felt the familiar hesitation, smiled, and called out, "It's only one of her little tricks in this sort of weather. She has always done it. We can let him lie in peace." Here a singularly prolonged and vivid series of lightning flashes lit up the low black clouds and the streaming ship. An enormous thunderclap roared out almost within hand's reach, and the wind turned without the slightest warning, filling her staysail crack full and bringing the surprise 4 points up, heading straight into a very high sea with far greater speed. Her first plunge sent her entire forecastle deep under green water. The whole ship pitched at such an angle and with such force that Jack, dead asleep in his hanging cot after 36 hours on deck, was dashed violently against the beams overhead. "I doubt she will ever rise again," said Pullings to himself, and the glow of the binnacle lights showed the same grave expectation of the end on the faces of the men at the wheel. Everything seemed to be happening very slowly. The bowsprit and part of the forecastle heaved up as dark as a whale in the white turmoil. The enormous body of water filling the waist surged aft, flooding the quarterdeck and bursting the cabin bulkhead inwards. In the almost continual lightning, the men of the watch could be made out clinging in bunches to the lifelines that had long since been stretched fore and aft between the guns. And before the water had poured from the quarterdeck scuppers, Jack Aubrey was seen swarming up the ladder in his nightshirt.
"Does she steer?"
he cried, and without waiting for the answer he took the wheel. The subtle current of vibrations between the thrust of successive waves on the rudder told him that all was well. His ship was answering as she had always answered. But as he peered down at the compass, his blood dripping over the glass turned the binnacle light red.
"You are hurt, sir," said Pullings.
"Damn that,"
said Jack, heaving on the wheel to spill the wind.
"Haul up the foresail. Forward there, look alive. Man the fore clew garnets."
This was in fact the last of the storm's more outrageous freaks. At the change of the watch, the wind, returning to the east-northeast, whipped the clouds off the moon, showing a tolerably dismal sight. Jib-boom, spritsail-yard and bumpkins carried away, bowsprit and foreyard sprung, and spanker-boom broken, together with a great deal of cordage. Dismal, but by no means desperate. No hands had been lost. Little water had got in below, and although the cabin was bare, damp, austere, and, with the loss of its bulkhead, stripped of all privacy, by breakfast time the ship was making a creditable 5 knots under topsails alone in a moderate slackening gale. The galley fires were in full action, and Killick had recovered his coffee mill from the bilges, where some irrational blast had hurled it when the carpenter's mate went below to attend to the well. Jack Aubrey had a bloody bandage round his head, obscuring one eye. He usually wore his long yellow hair neatly plaited and clubbed with a broad ribbon behind his neck, but so far he had not had time to wash the pints of clotted blood out of it, and the stiffened locks stood out in all direction, giving him a most inhuman look. Yet he was pleased with the way the ship's company had behaved. No moaning over short commons, though biscuit and cheese and small beer had been their fare for 3 days. No hanging back when they were required to go aloft. No skulking below. no wry looks, and his remaining eye had a benevolent expression.
"It is a remarkable fact," he observed at breakfast, "that in the course of many years at sea, I have never yet come across an incompetent carpenter. Bosuns, yes, because they often toppet the tyrant and turn the hands awkward. Even gunners, who cannot always be brought to accept the slightest change, but not carpenters. They seem to have their trade born in them. Our Mr. Bentley has almost finished the larboard bumpkin, and the bowsprit is already fished. We can... What the devil are they hallooing about in the waist?"
Bending and looking forward under the long overhang of the quarter-deck, he saw the men who had been set to repair the gripes all standing up and shouting to the lookout at the masthead.
"I beg pardon for not knocking, sir," said Pullings, running in, "but there is nothing to knock on. A sail, sir, hull down to leeward."
"Hull down? Then, in that case, we have time to finish our coffee," said Jack. "Sit down, Tom, and let me pour you a cup. It tastes a little odd, but at least it is hot and wet."
"Hot and wet it is, sir," said Pullings. "And to match you in, I'm afraid you must have had quite a tiresome night of it, Doctor. Your cabin is a rare old shambles, if I may use the expression."
"At one time I was deeply uneasy, I will admit," said Stephen. "It appeared to me through my dreams that some criminal hand had left the door open and that I should be exposed to the falling damps. But then I perceived that there was no door at all, and composed my mind to sleep."
Immediately after breakfast, the Surprise sent up her topgallant masts. It had soon become apparent that the chase was of no great consequence, but even so Jack began methodically spreading his canvas until she threw a fine bow wave, and the water sang down her side in a long curve, drawing a wake as straight and urgent as though she had been in pursuit of the Manila galleon. She had the wind on her starboard quarter, and now she could just bear weather stunsails alow. This was the first time Jack had really driven her since they left Chelmerston, the first time the new hands had seen what she was capable of. The speed pleased every man aboard, and not only the speed, but the ship's gallantry, the way she took the seas under her bow and tossed them aside. Although the wind was more moderate, it now blew across the current and the remaining swell, cutting it up in an ugly fashion, yet she ran through the short, uneven seas as sweetly as ever a ship could run. And when the log was heaved at 4 bells in the forenoon watch, taking 10 knots clean off the reel, there was a universal cheer. There was very little likelihood of trouble, but even so Jack had the hands piped early to dinner, watch by watch, and most of them soon returned, eating what they could carry in order to miss nothing. The chase had early been seen to be a crippled fore-and-aft vessel, and the probability of her being Babington's schooner grew stronger the nearer she came. Her foremast was sound, and she had foresail, for topsail, and a fine array of jibs, while her people were working extremely hard on a jury mainmast. But it was no use. Even if they did manage to set a mainsail on it, they must be overhauled quite soon. Uninjured and beating into the wind, she had outsailed the Tartarus, but crippled and above all sailing large, she was no sort of match for the Surprise.
"So that is a schooner," said Martin, as they watched her from the forecastle. "How can you tell?" "It has 2 masts. The second is now being attempted to be erected."
"But brigs, ketches, bylanders, galliots and doggers also have 2 masts. What is the difference?"
"Curlews and whimbrels have a general similarity, and both have 2 wings, yet to any but the most superficial observer there is an evident difference."
"There is the difference of size, eye stripe and voice.
Bating the voice, much the same applies to these 2-masted vessels. The accustomed eye," said Stephen, not without a certain complacency, "at once distinguishes the equivalent of eye stripes, wing bars, and semi-palmated feet."
"Perhaps I shall come to it in time," said Martin. "But there are also luggers, bean cods, and herring busses."
And having considered this for a while, he went on,
"Yet surely it is very curious that apart from some pilchard boats off the Lizard and the 2 men of war, this should be the first vessel we have seen in such a length of days. I remember the chops of the channel as being crowded with shipping, vast convoys, sometimes stretching over miles, and separate ships or small groups on their own."
"I believe," said Maturin, "that to the mariner paths are stretched across the ocean according to wind and weather. These he follows with as little thought or concern as a Christian might walk down Sackville Street, cross Carlisle Bridge, past Trinity College, and so come to Stephen's Green, that haunt of dryads, each more elegant than the last. Captain Aubrey, on the other hand, has taken care to avoid these paths, as do indeed the smugglers whom that disagreeable cutter was looking for. I have little doubt that the vessel over there, the schooner, is one of them. In this, Dr. Maturin was mistaken. Certainly the schooner was built for speed, and she might very well have carried contraband, but an even more discerning eye would have seen that while even now a small crew was furiously labouring with backstays and a main topsail yard, another body of men and three women were clustered at the taffrail, waving and calling out. The very picture of a retaken prize, or rather a prize about to be retaken. The surprise swept closer and ranged alongside, taking the wind out of the schooner's sails. She fired a gun to windward, and the schooner struck her colours.
"Shipmates," said Jack Aubrey in a strong voice, "you all know the terms of our agreement? If any man should so far forget himself as to rob any prisoner, or ill-use him, or pillage the schooner, he will be turned out of the ship. Lower down the blue cutter."
Yet the schooner, the Merlin, proved not to be a retaken prize at all, nor, whatever her captain, a French-speaking American from Louisiana, might say, was she an independent privateer. From the enormously prolix yet concordant testimony of the released prisoners, it became apparent that she was the consort of a much more formidable ship, the Spartan, fitted out by a Franco-American consortium to prey on the West Indian trade of the Allies. Jack knew the Spartan very well indeed, having chased her for 2 days and two nights through fair weather and foul, very foul. He had the highest opinion of her captain as a seaman, yet even so he was astonished to learn that he had taken no less than 5 prizes this voyage, 2 Port Royal sugar ships, whose slowness had separated them from their convoy in the night, and 3 other West Indiamen with even more valuable cargoes of indigo, coffee, logwood, ebony, old fustic and hides that, being fast sailors, had chanced it on their own. And still more astonished to learn that they had all 5 been moored in the harbour of Horta on Fayal, while their captains, the wives of those that sailed in married comfort, and the merchants of their factors had been packed off to France in the schooner, there to make what arrangements they could to ransom themselves, their ships, and their cargoes.
"Why in heaven's name did he not make for home as fast as ever he could pelt with such a prodigious haul?" asked Jack. "I have never heard of a private ship doing so amazingly well in 1 short cruise, nor in a long one neither."
The answer was obvious enough, but nobody found it out until that evening. The schooner's captain gave nothing away, and his small crew was incapable of doing so, being totally ignorant of the general design, while Jack's and Pullings's minds were too much occupied with the former prisoners, the present prisoners, and the refitting of the prize. The American captain, the merchants and their wives had come aboard at once, and ordinarily, out of common decency, Jack would have invited them to dinner. The officer's hour was fast approaching. But at present he had no cabin in which to feed them, nor had he anything that he could put on the table if a cabin had existed.
"Mr. DuPont, sir," he said to the American captain, who was brought aft in reasonable privacy to show the Merlin's papers, "you could oblige me extremely, were you so inclined." "I should be happy to do anything in my power, sir," replied DuPont, looking doubtfully at the figure before him.
Privateer captains had a solid reputation for brutal rapacity, and Jack Aubrey, tall, gaunt, unwashed, with yellow bristles glinting on his unshaved face, his bloody bandage bloodier still from recent activity, and his blood-stiffened hair still hanging about him like a horribly dyed female wig, a figure from which the merchants' wives had recoiled with silent horror, though accustomed to the sea.
"Anything within my trifling means." "The fact of the matter is, we are short of provisions. For the ship's sake, and for my own, I should be distressed if I were obliged to offer you and these ladies a dinner consisting of salt beef, dried peas, and beer so small as to be scarcely drinkable."
"Command me, sir, I beg," cried DuPont, who had foreseen something more disagreeable by far. "My stores are not inconsiderable. Though the tea is almost gone, and though my cook is black, he is not without skill. I bought him from a man who fairly worshipped his belly." This was an erroneous form of worship, sure, but after such a blow and after so many days with little more than ship's bread, the captain and the officers of the Surprise felt that there might be something in it. Even their guests were agreeably surprised, for although the black man had always done them well, he now burst out with an extraordinary profusion. His vol-au-vent made the ladies stretch their eyes, and his apple tart was worthy of Fladong's. The Surprises attributed this to his happiness and gratitude, for as soon as he came across, Killick, who as captain's steward was naturally in charge of these things, took him by the arm and called out slowly into his perhaps uncomprehending ear, "You free men, now, huzzay!" making the gesture of one released from his manacles, and thus signifying that the moment the black set foot on a British ship, he was no longer a slave. "You," touching his breast, "free men."
"Pardon me, sir," said the black, "my name is Smith."
But he spoke so gently, for fear of giving offence, that in the midst of the cheerful hullabaloo his words had no influence whatsoever upon public opinion. The feast took place in the gunroom, with Jack Aubrey, now smoothed and presentable, at one end of the long table and Pullings at the other, and when it was over at last, Stephen and the man who had sat on his right walked on the leeward side of the quarterdeck, smoking little paper cigars in the Spanish manner. They conversed in Spanish, too, for his companion, Jaime Guzman, was a Spaniard, originally from Avila in Old Castile, a partner in the Cadiz firm that had bought the greater part of the old fustic in the captured William and Mary. He could speak a certain amount of commercial English, but he had not been on speaking terms with any of his fellow captives for a great while. He was naturally a communicative man, yet for weeks and weeks he had been deprived of the power of speech, and now he talked with an almost alarming volubility.
"Those women, those odious, odious women," he said, smoke issuing from his mouth and nose, "would never allow me this indulgence, even on the outward voyage. Voluptuous civets! But quite apart from that, I found them all profoundly disagreeable. At one time I thought of helping them to improve, but then I reflected that whoever washes an ass's head loses both his time and soap. None of those people would ever have been received in Avila. Your godfather's grandmother would never have consented to receive them."
An account of the Avila of Guzman's youth led to observations on the town of Almaden, where Guzman's brother supervised the business side of the quicksilver mines, and upon Cadiz, where Guzman now had his being, a sadly depraved and abandoned city.
"Like yourself, Don Esteban," he said, "I am an old and mellow Christian, and I am very fond of ham. But there is, as who should say, no ham to be had in Cadiz. And why is this? It is because, under the pretense of being new Christians, the people are all half Moors or half Jews. There is no dealing with them, as my poor brother finds. They are shockingly dishonest, two-faced, grasping, and, like most Andalusians, inhumanly eager for the gain."
"He who wishes to grow rich in a year will be hanged in 6 months," observed Stephen.
"They cannot be hanged too early nor too often," said Guzman. "Take the case of my poor brother now. Quicksilver has to be sent to the New World, of course. They cannot extract gold without it. When England and Spain were at war, it was sent by frigates. But time and again they were taken through the treachery of the wicked clerks of Cadiz, who told the Jews of Gibraltar the time of sailing and even the number of bags. For you must know, Don Esteban, that quicksilver is packed in sheepskin bags of half a hundredweight apiece. Now that the war has changed, no frigates can be spared, still less ships of the line. So, having waited for years, my poor brother, pressed and harassed on all sides, has chartered the most powerful and trustworthy privateer on the coast, a ship called the Athul, much the same size as this, to carry 150 tons to Cartagena. 150 tons, Don Esteban! 6,000 bags! Can you imagine 6,000 bags of quicksilver?"
They took several turns, imagining 6,000 bags, and Guzman went on.
But I am afraid the same wickedness has been at play. The Spartan knows very well that the Athul was to sail 8 days ago and to touch at the Azores. That is why she is waiting. Perhaps she has taken her already. But the great point is this, and I know it because the young officers in the Spartan were very far from being as discreet as Mr. Dupont. At the end of the month, the American frigate Constitution and a sloop will pass by the Azores, coming from the south. The Spartan and her fleet of prizes will join her and sail back to the States in safety.
Jack Aubrey had the rare virtue of listening to an account without interrupting, and on this occasion he even waited for the afterword.
I tell you all this, Jack, as I received it. I have reasons for believing that Guthman's words about the Gibraltar Jews are mistaken. He longs for the return of the Holy Office with all its ardent zeal. But I think it by no means improbable that this Franco-American concern should know about the present shipping of Quicksilver, and it seems to me that Guthman's good faith can hardly be questioned. What do you think of his observations about the Constitution?
If Mr. Hull still has her, she is likely to be as near her day as is humanly possible. In their navy he has the reputation of being as regular as old time. We could not look at her, of course. She carries 44 24-pounders, fires a broadside of 768 pounds, and has scantlings like a ship of the line. They call her Old Ironsides. Nevertheless...
His voice trailed away, and his mind's eye beheld a chart of the Atlantic between 35 and 50 degrees north, with the Azores in the middle. The Spartan would be cruising between St. Michael's and St. Mary to windward, in order to have the weather gauge of the Athul when she appeared. And at this time of the year, windward meant west, or something north of west. The recent blow might well have made the Athul lie to, though it might possibly have set her forward. On the other hand, it would certainly have held the Constitution back, an essential factor in the plan that was taking shape in his mind, the plan of leading the Spartan to believe that the surprise was the Athul, at least long enough for them to come to grips. The dates, the recent weather, the probable speed of an efficient though unhurried Athul, and the surprise's actual position presented themselves in due order. And it appeared to him that if the breeze stayed fair and if the ship could log 125 miles a day, there was a possibility of getting there in time. Not a very strong possibility, but one at least worth a great deal of effort.
If the breeze stayed fair.
The barometer had been rising and falling most erratically, and there was no forecast to be made. The only thing to do was to carry on without one, and straight away. Once more Stephen heard the words,
"There is not a moment to be lost."
And then Jack ran up on deck to tell Pullings to set all hands to work on the refitting of the Merlin with the utmost speed. Returning, he said,
"Stephen, would you be so kind as to interpret while I ask the gentleman about the Athul?"
From his connections and his calling, Guthman knew much more about ships than the ordinary landsman, and his statement that the Athul had 3 masts, that she was bark-rigged, and that she gauged about 500 tons, was perfectly convincing. So was his description of her as being painted a beautiful blue, with her black port lids looking quite like those of a man of war. But these words made Jack Aubrey very pensive. Rigging the Surprise bark fashion presented no difficulty, since it meant little more than unshipping her crossjack and mizzen-topsail yards, so that she carried only 4 and aft sails on that mast. But this had been intended as a trial cruise, no more, and she carried little in the way of stores. Black port lids were very well, since she had them already, never having deviated from the Nelson checker, but the blue sides, that was another matter.
"Pass the word for Mr. Bentley," he called,
and when the carpenter appeared,
"Mr. Bentley, what do we possess in the way of blue paint?"
"Blue paint, sir. We have just enough to give the blue cotter a couple of coats, spread thin, precious thin."
Jack thought for a moment and said to Stephen, "Pray ask whether the blue is light or dark."
And when it appeared that the Athul was pale as the early morning sky, he turned to the carpenter to find how they stood in the matter of plain white. The answer was almost equally discouraging, a small hundredweight, with a shove.
"Well, well," said Jack, "we must do what we can. Tell me, Mr. Bentley, how does the schooner come along?"
"Oh, sir," said the carpenter, brightening at once,
Our second best spare for topmast, with a butt corked onto the heel and a little trimming at the partners, has made her as pretty a mainmast as you could wish. Boatswain is setting up the shrouds this minute, and as soon as they are rattled down we can send up a mighty elegant topmast.
You have been uncommon busy, Mr. Bentley, you and your crew.
Busy, sir? Bees ain't in it.
Bees were not in it the next day either, for in the course of his nightly pacing of the deck, Jack had hit upon a solution to the problem of changing the Surprise's outward appearance. Several coats of blue, laid on thick, would be needed to cover the broad black bands above and below the white belt with the black port lids in it, and all the paint they possessed would not give more than a single coat to half one side. One coat would do on the white, it would be useless on the black. Yet paint would lie on canvas. Paint lay admirably well on white canvas, and on white canvas a willing mind could make a very little light blue go a very long way. As soon as the idlers were called in the first morning light, he had a long conference with the sailmaker, finding out just what was thinnest, whitest, and most easily spared in the sailroom. Some good number 8 had to be sacrificed, but most of what they chose was poor, thin stuff, fit only for repairing to gallants or royals, for the Surprise was sold with all her equipment, and these sails had been sun-bleached and worn threadbare in the tropical Pacific during her last commission. When the decks were dry, for nothing but imminent action could suspend the cleaning of the almost spotless ship, the canvas was spread, measured, remeasured, tried against the topsides, marked with great precision, tried again, and eventually cut out and painted. The work was done on the quarterdeck, a very carefully shrouded quarterdeck. With the present sea running and the present speed required, there was no question of hanging stages over the side, pinning the cloth and painting it there. The forecastle was too confined, and the waist with its booms and the boats upon them had too little free run. While the gangways were in perpetual use, for the blessed north-northeaster had backed surprisingly in the course of the night, the weather was most unsettled, and although it was still a fine t'gallant gale, it was now only 1 point free, so that continual attention to brace and bowline was called for, and very careful steering to get the best out of her. When Stephen came on deck, therefore, he found the after part of the ship unusually crowded, unusually busy. As it often happened, he had spent much of the night awake, thinking about Diana, and seeing brilliantly clear mental images of her, particularly one of her setting her horse at a monstrous fence where many men turned back, and she flying over with never a pause. Then at about 2 o'clock he had taken his usual draught, sleeping late and waking stupid. Coffee had revived him somewhat, and he would have sat with it longer if a glance at his watch had not told him that presently he must be about his duties, attending at the sick bay with Martin, while Padine, the acting loblolly boy, beat a brass basin at the mainmast, and sang, "Let the sick assemble here, for to see the doctor dear," since although he stammered extremely in ordinary speech, he could sing quite well. First, however, Stephen meant to look at the sky, bid his companions a good morning, and see whether the Merlin was in company. Yet he had barely climbed the ladder. He had barely received more than a general impression of warmth, brilliant sunlight, brilliant sky, and a crowd of blinding white sails reaching up into it, before a cry of universal disapprobation wiped the smile off his face.
"Sir! Sir! Get off it, sir! Stand back, doctor, for heaven's sake, stand back! Or you will fall into the pot!"
And the new hands were as vehement as the old Surprises, and much ruder. One called him Great Ox, for they had very soon understood what was afoot, and nothing could have exceeded their eagerness to engage with a Spartan, nor their zeal in preparing for the engagement, hypothetical though it might be.
"Hold hard," said Jack, grasping him by the elbows. "Do not stir. Padine. Padine there! Bring new shoes for your master. Do you hear me now?"
The new shoes came. Stephen stepped into them, gazed at the blue-painted strips stretching away to the taffrail, at the stern but relenting faces turned towards him, said to Jack,
"Oh, how sorry I am! I should never have looked at the sky!" And then, after a moment, "Padine, it is the face again, I find."
The face it was. The poor soul's cheek was swollen so that the skin shone bright, and he answered with no more than a groan.
Five bells struck. Padine beat his basin and chanted his piece in a strangled voice. Yet although the surprise had the usual number of hypochondriacs aboard, the activity on deck was so earnest, intense, and single-minded that not a single patient reported to the sick bay, except Padine himself. Stephen and Martin looked at him sadly. For some time they had suspected an impacted wisdom tooth, but there was nothing that either of them could do. And presently Dr. Maturin, having taken Padine's pulse and looked into his mouth and throat again, poured out a generous dose of his usual physic, tied up the face in a rabbit-eared bandage, and excused him duty.
"It is almost your panacea," observed Martin, referring to the laudanum. "At least it does something," said Stephen, drawing up his shoulders and spreading his hands. "And we are so very helpless."
A pause.
"I came across a capital word the other day, quite new to me. Psychopanacea, the all-night sleep of the soul. I dare say it has long been familiar to you from your studies in divinity."
"I associate it with the name of Gordon," said Martin. "I believe he thought it erroneous."
"I associate it with the thought of comfort," said Stephen, caressing his bottle. "Deep, long-lasting comfort. Though I admit I have no notion whether the state itself is sound doctrine or not. Shall we walk on to the forecastle? I do not believe they will persecute us there."
They did not. They were far too busy with their sailcloth and with painting the white band on the ship's windward side, at least after the forechains, by leaning perilously out of the gunports. The forecastle deck was tilted 11 or 12 degrees to the sun, and the warmth was wonderfully agreeable after a long and desolate English winter.
Blue sea, blue sky, white clouds, white sails, a general brilliance. What could be more pleasing? Said Stephen. A little sportive foam from a bow wave does not signify. Indeed, it is refreshing, and the sun penetrates to one's very bones.
After dinner, a hurried, scrappy meal eaten with little appetite, the hands returned to their work, the surgeons to their contemplation, this time with the comfort of spare paunch mats to sit upon. The Merlin, which had been sailing dutifully in the frigate's wake since dawn, a cable's length away, now overhauled her, making 8 knots for the Surprise's 6, being so much faster close to the wind, and coming alongside, hailed to say that they were taking mackerel as fast as they could haul them in. Yet even this, the hands' favourite amusement, favoured above all in times of short allowance, could not disturb them from their task. Several of the new men could navigate. Most of the old Surprises had a very fair notion of where the ship should lie if she was to have a chance of finding the Spartan in time. They had all seen the officers taking the sun's altitude at noon, and they had all, with great satisfaction, heard Davidge say, 12 o'clock, sir, if you please, and 43 degrees 55 minutes north. While the captain replied,
Thank you, Mr. Davidge. Make it 12.
This meant that as far as latitude was concerned, they had only about 6 degrees to run down in 3 days. There was perhaps a little westing to be made up, but even so an average speed of 5 knots should do it handsomely. And hitherto no heave of the log had ever shown less than 6. They might be in action, gainful action, on Thursday, and to spoil their chances of closing with the Spartan for the sake of a few mackerel, Spanish mackerel at that, would be foolish indeed. Even so, between 2 strokes of his paintbrush, Bondon ran forward with a basket of hand lines, and Stephen and Martin, sharing strips of a red handkerchief between them as bait, plucked the fishes from the sea. They had half filled the basket. They had caught sight of bonitos pursuing the mackerel, and their hopes were on tiptoe when there came the dismal cry, Man overboard!
Come up the sheets! Called Jack,
leaping over the painted strips and onto the hammocks in their netting. Men threaded their way with the utmost speed, though still with the utmost care, to their appointed ropes, and within the minute there was an all-pervading roar of sails flacking and slatting as they split the wind. A horrible sound. Jack had his eye fixed on the man, a painter who had leaned out just too far, and saw that he was swimming. He also saw the Merlin port her helm and drop the boat from her stern davits, and he rebuttoned the coat he had been about to fling off.
"Back the topsail!"
he said. And the way came off the Surprise. An odd, dead feeling aboard after so much urgent, rhythmic life. The Merlin's boat, with the rescued man aboard, caught her up and, warned by vehement cries not to touch her sides, hooked on at the stern. Pullings came up the ladder, then some bags were passed after him, and last came the sodden object of their solicitude,
an elderly surprise by the name of Place, Joe Place. He was not welcomed aboard, though he had many friends and even relations in the frigate. He was not congratulated on being alive.
"I dare say the lubber dropped his ing brush as well," said one of his shipmates as he passed, bowed with shame.
"You had better go and shift yourself, Place," said Jack coldly, "if your improvident habits have left you any dry clothes."
And raising his voice, he gave the series of orders that set the ship progressively back in motion. Anything sudden might have endangered the topgallants, though it was true that the breeze already had a most unpleasant, declining feel about it.
"How does she handle, Tom?"
asked Jack, nodding towards the Merlin.
"Oh, as sweet as he could wish, sir," said Pullings. "Dry and weatherly, and steers herself. But, sir, the ladies are creating something cruel. Insist upon being taken to England directly. We'll report us. We'll have the law of us. We shall be transported to Botany Bay."
"I thought I heard them screeching when you hailed us about the mackerel,"
said Jack.
"You can tell them that it will soon be over. We cannot stay out any longer than Thursday unless we eat our belts and the soles of our shoes. I shall have to put the people on short allowance tomorrow in any event, 4 upon 2. And even if we did stay out, I do not think there would be any chance at all of finding our man after Thursday. Indeed, Thursday is the very farthest limit, perhaps even beyond it."
"As for belts and shoes, sir, I have ventured to bring a few comforts over in those bags. They were voluntary offerings," he added, seeing Jack's look of reserve and feeling that the word pillage might have entered his mind.
"Thank you, Tom,"
said Jack absently. He walked forward, whistling, and scratched the backstay.
"If the wind hauls northerly again and strengthens, as I hope and pray it will—"
"Amen, sir," said Pullings, also scratching the backstay.
"Then we shall probably leave you behind. Do not crack on beyond reason to keep company, nothing beyond your topsails, but rendezvous at 37 degrees 30 minutes north, 25 degrees 30 minutes west, and thank you for the comforts."
37 degrees 30 minutes north, 25 degrees 30 minutes west it is, sir," said Pullings, stepping over the taffrail.
Yet in spite of the whistling and backstay scratching, and there was not a seaman aboard who did not follow his captain's example, the wind died sickeningly throughout the day and throughout the night, so that the Merlin, far from being left behind, was obliged to take in everything but a double-reefed foresail to keep her station.
"It is a rum go," said Davidge in the gunroom, "but I could have sworn the wind would haul into the north from the look of the day.
So could the captain, although the glass was behaving so strangely. But perhaps drinking a health to Boreas might help."
He ladled punch into the glasses. Pulling's comforts had included a bottle of brandy for each of the officers, and said,
"Gentlemen, to Boreas."
"To Boreas," said West, "but in decent moderation. No close-reefed topsails in the graveyard watch."
"To Boreas, by all means," said Stephen. "Yet should he be absent, just for an hour or so in the morning, Mr. Aubrey would have the consolation of swimming, and Mr. Martin and I that of gathering specimens in the boat. We passed through a flotilla of nondescript jellyfish this afternoon, none of which could be reached with a hand-net."
"We are very grateful for your mackerel and the bonitos," said West, "but I do not believe there is a single man in the ship that would give up a mile of southing for all the jellyfishes in the world, no, nor yet 100 yards, even if you were to throw in a barrel of oysters for every mess."
Yet Tuesday's sun, rising over an opalescent sea with barely a tremor on its surface except where the boat made its trifling wake, lit up the surgeons as they peered into the translucent depths or took up small organisms and floating weed. Jack Aubrey did not, in fact, console himself by swimming, though he had a great mind to it after a sleepless night, trying to urge the ship on in the dying breeze by force of will. While at every other glass the log took out less and less of its line, until at last not even a single knot ran off the reel, in spite of all the help the quartermaster could give it. No swimming. As soon as there was light enough, he began to organize stages over the side, and by a little after breakfast time the ship, though drooping in every sail, was once again a hive of industry.
"This is perfect!"
he called over the still water to Pullings in the Merlin, a quarter of a mile abeam and turning as she very slowly drifted farther.
"This is just what I've been praying for!"
"My God forgive you,"
murmured Killick, a few feet below him in the now reassembled cabin.
"Now we can finish off the upper black strake and then deal with the lower. We can get right down to the copper."
A few of the simpler men from Shelmerston may have been deceived,
but those who had long sailed with Captain Aubrey either nodded to one another or smiled privately. They knew very well that there were times when a commanding officer was required to talk just like this, just as a parson was required to preach on Sundays. They did not believe him for a moment, yet this did not affect their purpose, and although the watch after watch of calm had taken away from their first enthusiasm, they worked on doggedly. If there was the slightest chance of getting the Barkey to the height of the Azores by Thursday, it would not be their fault if she was not ready. And indeed, by noon, both lower black strakes were coated with sailcloth, pinned tight with close-set copper nails above and below the waterline, the guns having been run across the deck in either case to heel the ship. The very last of the blue paint had been laid on, parsimoniously scraped out to cover the greatest possible extent. The blue did not quite meet the surface, but that did not signify, since it shaded down to a rim of mixed filth and cook's slush in the usual sea-going way. At all events, Guthman reported from Stephen's boat that she and the Athul now looked as like one another as two chickpeas from the same pod. Now all that remained was changing her into a bark and striking down her tall and too recognisable main-to-gallant-mast. But this was an operation that Jack meant to leave to the last, since the rig would reduce her speed, and in the present case, speed was everything. It was everything, to be sure, and at noon the ship lay there motionless, not having run 80 miles since the last observation. Crueler still, crueler by far, was the breeze when at last it came, whispering up from the south, right in their teeth and strengthening hour by hour. The Surprise dutifully beat up into it, tack upon tack, but it was with death in their hearts that the men braced round the heavy yards and trimmed the sails to the finest possible degree. Stephen and Martin came upon deck at the second cry of "All hands about ship!" after a prolonged session where their pelagic crustaceans, some of them certainly undescribed and quite unknown to science.
"What a pleasure it is to be moving again!" cried Stephen. "How the ship bounds along!"
He caught Jack Aubrey's black look of contained exasperation, his tight-shut mouth. He noticed the grim faces of the wasters and afterguard, the general silence. And at the roar of "Helmsley!" he murmured,
"Let us go downstairs again."
They sat, drawing their specimens by the light of the great stern window, and when Killick came in, Stephen said to him,
"Pray, Killick, what is the general situation?"
"Well, sir," said Killick, "as far as I can see, we might as well pack up and go home. Here we are, plying to windward as hard as ever we can, toiling and moiling, all hands about ship every other glass, and what do we gain? Not above a mile southing in the hour. And if the wind gets up, if we have to take our t'gallants in, we shall lose ground. The Barkey is a very weatherly ship, but even she makes some leeway, and if it comes on to blow right chronic, even she must lose some southing."
"Yet, surely," said Martin, "if this wind holds us back, it must do the same for the Athul."
"Oh!" cried Killick, with a kind of howl. "But don't you see the Athul, as she calls herself, is sailing west? Not south, like we, but west. Sailing from Cadiz to St. Michael's. So she has this wind on her beam. On her beam!" pointing to the ship's side to make his meaning clear. "So there are those buggers with their sheets hauled aft, standing there with folded arms, spitting to leeward like the lords of creation, making 6 or 7 knots as easy as kiss my hand, bearing off our lawful prize."
Indignation choked him. Yet it was this same Killick who stood by Stephen's cot the next morning, Wednesday morning, with a shining face, shaking the ropes on which it hung and repeating,
"Captain's compliments, and should the doctor like to see a glorious sight? Captain's compliments, and should the doctor like to see—"
As Stephen slipped from his cot, he observed that the deck was tilted by at least 25 degrees. Leaning cautiously against the bulkhead, he stepped into his breeches, huddled on a disgraceful old greatcoat, and emerged, blinking into a brilliant day. The Surprise was lying right over, white water all along her lee rail and spouting high from her cathead. The strong breeze was a little too far forward for stunsails to set,
but with Jack Aubrey's old practice of sending up cablets and light hawsers as extra preventer stays, she nevertheless had topgallants abroad, and she was turning along at a splendid rate. Happy seamen all along the windward gangway, laughter on the forecastle.
"There you are, Doctor!" cried Jack. "Good morning to you! Ain't it charming?" The breeze veered in a black squall soon after you had turned in and began to blow from west by south in the morning watch, but I believe it may haul north of west. But come with me. Mind your step."
He led him, still blinking and heavy, to the taffrail, and said,
"There. That's what I woke you up for."
At first Stephen could not make it out. Then he realized that the near sea to leeward was filled with whales. An immense school of sperm whales travelling in one direction, passing above, below, round, and amongst a school of right whales travelling in the other. Everywhere he looked, there were huge dark forms rising, blowing, sometimes lying awash, more often diving again almost at once, often showing their enormous flukes above the surface as they did so. Some were so close he could hear their breath, their strong, almost explosive outward breath, and their heaving inspiration.
"Lord, Lord," he said at last, "what a splendor of creation!"
"I am so glad you saw them," said Jack. "In 5 minutes' time it would have been too late."
"How I wish I had sent to tell Martin."
"Oh, he was about already. He's in the mizzen-top, as you see."
So he was, the intrepid soul. And they waved their pocket handkerchiefs to one another, and as he put his away, Stephen looked covertly at the sun. It was on the left hand, not far above the horizon. The ship was therefore racing down towards the longed-for south, and he could safely say, "I give you joy of your propitious wind."
"Many thanks," said Jack, smiling, but shaking his head. "It is certainly better late than never at all. Let us go and drink our coffee."
"You have but little hope, I am afraid," said Stephen in the cabin, balancing his cup as well as he could.
"Not very much, I confess. But if the wind does haul northerly, and if it only holds true, there is just a chance we may run off the distance. If nothing carries away," he added, touching the tabletop.
Nothing had carried away by the midday observation, when it was found that the Surprise had made 87 miles of southing, almost all of it since the morning watch. The wind, though slightly less strong, was still veering, and a little after dinner-time the first weather stunsails appeared. All hands watched how they set, with the keenest attention, and shortly afterwards, when the log was heaved, the report,
10 knots and 3 fathoms, sir, if you please,"
was greeted with a satisfied chuckle all along the weather gangway to the forecastle. The ship was filled with reviving, ebullient hope. Only Perdine did not share it. In the morning Stephen had poulticed him no more, hoping to deal with a possible imposthume by that means. He had fed Perdine soup with a spoon at noon, renewing the poultice, but now in the afternoon watch the pain grew worse, and Perdine, rising from his hammock, went to the medicine chest, dosed himself with laudanum, and stood considering the bottle, a long, thin dropping flask with marks on its side. Having pondered between the spasms of pain, he put the bottle under his jacket and walked to Mr. Martin's cabin. There was nobody in this part of the ship, but even if there had been, he would have passed unnoticed, since he looked after Mr. Martin just as he looked after the doctor. Here he took Martin's bottle of brandy, filled the laudanum to its former mark, topped up the brandy with water, and replaced the bottles in their lockers and himself in his hammock. He was quite alone, not only because most of the hands were taking such pleasure in the frigate's course, but also because the cry, "Sail ho!" from the masthead had brought all those who were busy elsewhere up from the storerooms, the cable tiers, or the manger at the run. The sail was already visible from the deck, some 5 miles to leeward, yet with the Surprise having so much canvas spread, and with the forecastle so regularly swept by green water, it was not easy to get a clear view of her, even from the tops. But perched high on the main jack cross-trees above the topgallant, a post familiar to him from his youth when he was a midshipman in this same ship, Jack had the whole ring of the horizon at his command. The stranger, though ship-rigged, was quite certainly not the Spartan. Apart from anything else, she was much too far north. In spite of her Spanish colours, she was most probably British, square-sterned and British-built, most probably a West Indiaman. She had been crowding on sail ever since they caught sight of one another, and now, as he watched, her mizzen topmast carried away,
and she was brought by the lee in a horrible flurry of canvas. If she chose, the surprise could bear up and be alongside her in half an hour. But even if there had been an equal chance of her being lawful prize, that half hour was too precious to be spared. He shook his head, swiveled about on the jacks, and trained his glass northwards. The Merlin had been in sight in the forenoon watch. At present there was not so much as a nick in the horizon. He returned to the deck, the slender topgallant shrouds bending under his weight, and as he stepped from the hammock cloth to a carronade and so to the quarter-deck, the ship's company gazed silently at his face. He walked over to the binnacle, looked at the compass, and said,
"Very well thus, dice, and no higher."
The course was not to be altered. There was a certain sigh, a sort of rueful acquiescence, a general sound not unlike the expiration of two or three whales fairly close at hand, but nowhere a hint of disagreement or discontent. As the afternoon wore on, the wind lost rather more of its strength, but it also veered still farther, steadying at northwest by west, almost on her quarter. And as it moderated, so the surprise spread more canvas. Stunsails alow and aloft, royals, the rarely seen but useful spritsail topsail, all the jibs that would set, and a cloud of staysails. It was a noble spectacle, filling all hands with pleasure as something excellent in itself, not only as a means to an end. Jack was contemplating skysails when the sun, slanting westwards to a deep cloud bank away to starboard, made it clear that this would never do. Far from it. A great deal must be taken in before the watch was set, so that no sudden force of wind should oblige him to call all hands in the middle of the night. For although the breeze seemed firmly settled in the northwest, it might very well change in strength. A quiet night was of the first importance. All hands had been hard at it ever since last week's thundering blow began, and although in general their spirits were still high, this was by no means the same thing as a 3-day chase with the enemy in sight, which could keep men going without food or rest, and he saw evident signs of exhaustion. His own coxswain, for example, looked grey and old. The foremast jacks had little enough sleep as it was, without having that little broken during their watch below. And this was more than ever true before an engagement. The likelihood of an engagement tomorrow had never been anything but small, and now it was smaller still. Yet only a fool would reduce it even more, reduce it to the vanishing point after so much pains and such a glorious run. But then again, there was such a thing as being too cautious by half. For the chance to have any existence at all, the surprise must be present somewhere to windward between St. Michael's and St. Mary.
"All these things have to be balanced against one another," he said inwardly as he paced fore and aft.
And the result of his balancing was that the surprise sailed into the night with her topgallants abroad, whereas ordinarily she would have furled them and would have taken a reef in her topsails. She had done remarkably well today, and if she made no more than a steady 5 knots during the night she would still run off her 200 miles from noon to noon. By daylight he should have his landfall on the starboard bow, the high, rocky eastward tip on St. Michael's.
"Jack," said Stephen, looking up from his ruled paper as the cabin door opened, "I have just finished transposing a Sammartini duo for violin and cello. Should you like to try it after supper? Killick promises us pease pudding from the galley, followed by his own toasted cheese."
"Is it long?"
"It is not."
"Then I shall be very happy. But I mean to turn in early. Since Tom is away in the schooner, I shall take the middle watch."
Like many sailors, Jack Aubrey had early acquired the habit of going to sleep almost as he put his head on his pillow. But this night he remained at least in part awake. It was not that his mind was torturing itself again with detailed memories of his disgrace, nor with the long-lasting and potentially ruinous lawsuits that hung over him, but rather that, physically and mentally very tired indeed, he skimmed along the surface of the immediate present. He listened to the sound of the water against the ship's side, and that composite, omnipresent voice that came from the wind in the taut rigging and from the play of the hull, while at the same time, and more consciously, he traced the pattern of the music they had played, occasionally drifting away but always hearing the bells in due succession and always aware of the state of the wind. It was a strange state,
very rare for him, almost as restful as sleep and much nearer quiet happiness than anything he had known since his trial. He was up and dressed when Bondon came to call him, and he went straight up on deck.
"Good morning, Mr. West," he said,
looking at the gibbous moon, clear in a small-flecked sky.
"Good morning, sir," said West. "All's well, though the breeze slackens a little. You are an uncommon good relief, sir."
"Turn the glass," said the quartermaster at the con,
and Place, recognisable from his wheeze, padded forward and struck 8 bells. While the watches changed, Jack studied the logboard. The wind had not varied a single point in direction, though, as he knew very well, it had decreased, and readings of under 6 knots were more usual than those over. It was a warm night, though the breeze was north of west, and walking aft to the taffrail he saw with pleasure that the wake was luminous, a long, phosphorescent trail, the first he had seen this year. He heard the usual reports. 6 inches of water in the well, very moderate indeed after such a blow, but she had always been a dry ship, and the latest heave of the log, almost 7 knots. Perhaps the wind was picking up. The watch could scarcely have been more peaceful. No call to touch sheet or brace, no movement but the helmsman, the quartermasters, and the lookouts spelling one another, the heaving of the log, the striking of the bell. Now and then a man might go forward to the head, but most remained gathered there in the waist, a few talking in low tones, but most choosing a soft plank for a doze. Jack spent the greater part of it gazing at the hypnotic wake as it spun out mile after mile, or watching the familiar stars in their course. The breeze did freshen from time to time, and once he was able to chalk 7 knots 2 fathoms on the board. But it was never enough for any change of sail, nor did it alter this faintly moonlit, starlit, dreamlike sailing over the dark sea, except by adding a certain deep satisfaction. He handed over to Davidge and the starboard watch at 4 in the morning, gave orders that he was to be called with the idlers, went below and plunged straight into his usual profound sleep. At first light he was on deck again. The breeze was much as he had left it, though somewhat more westerly. The sky cleared except for cloud and haze to starboard. The idlers had already gathered round the pumps, a frosty, squalid group not yet washed or brushed, and well clear of the horizon to larboard, the newly risen Venus in her pale blue heaven looked all the purer by contrast. Having bade the quarterdeck good day, Jack said,
"Mr. Davidge, let us merely swab the decks this morning and flog them dry. Then, with the idlers at hand, for pumping will not take them 10 minutes, I believe we may start making sail."
That was one of the advantages of a crew of this kind. With the emphatic exception of the surgeon and his mate, all the idlers, the men who did not stand a watch, were very able seamen, as well as being highly skilled in their particular line. The sailmaker and his mates, the armourer, the gunner's mates, the carpenter's crew, the cooper, and all the rest of the specialists. Another advantage, reflected Jack Aubrey as he made his way up the weather rigging to the maintop and beyond, climbing easily, without hurry, scarcely thinking of his lofty path any more than a man going upstairs to the attic at home, another advantage was the hand's singular eagerness to please, not out of imposed discipline, but to avoid being turned away. Something quite unknown in his life at sea. In an hour or so hammocks would be piped up, and then they would be stowed in the nettings, properly rolled in 5 or 6 minutes, without driving, oaths, or rope's ends. Not many king's ships could say as much.
"Good morning, Webster,"
he said to the lookout at the topgallant cross-trees.
"Good morning, sir,"
said Webster, moving a few steps down the lee shrouds, leaving the cross-trees free.
"Nothing to westwards that I can make out, but maybe with your glass."
It was a very good glass, a Dollond achromatic, and sitting upon the cross-trees, Jack focused it carefully on the western horizon, sweeping the half-circle. But where St. Michael's should have been was cloud-bank, dark, sullen, purplish-grey, and impenetrable. After a while he pushed the telescope shut, slung it over his shoulder, and nodded to the lookout and returned to the deck. There, while his mind checked and rechecked the figures for the night's run, he began to spread more canvas. Well before hammocks were piped up, the Surprise was making just over 8 knots, and as he went below to work out his calculations once more on paper and transfer them to the chart, with various allowances for leeway and error, he said,
"It is absurd to be so anxious. I am become a perfect old woman."
"On deck there," called Webster from the masthead. "Land 3 points on the starboard bow."
His shrill voice pierced the general noise of both watches moving about and talking much more than was usual in a king's ship. It came clear through the open cabin door, and Jack, with a chart in front of him and a telltale compass in the beam over his head, saw that Ribera Point in St. Michael's should in fact bear southwest by south, exactly 3 points on the starboard bow. A knock on the door jamb and West came in.
"Lancer," he reported, 3 points on the starboard bow. I caught sight of it from the deck for a moment, the haze is lifting, and it seemed to me about 10 leagues off."
"Thank you, Mr. West," said Jack. "I shall come and look at it by and by."
A moment later the boatswain's call piped all hands to breakfast, and as though he had been waiting for the sound, Stephen hurried in.
"God love you, Jack," he said, talking rather loud over the muffled thunder of feet. "What land is this? Not our old friend Cape Flyaway, I trust?"
"Unless Cape Flyaway bears exactly southwest by south about 10 leagues, this should be the northeast point of St. Michael's," said Jack, showing the chart with his parallel rulers along the line of bearing.
"Yet you do not seem elated."
"I am pleased, certainly. But no, I am not, as who should say, elated. Feelings are curious. They come and go. And in any case, this is only one small step. There is still a great way to go."
"If you please, gents," said Killick, "there is a couple of fresh flying fish just come aboard that should be ate hot. There is a charming unction in a really fresh flying fish," said Stephen, setting to his plate. "May I trouble you for the bread barge? Tell, Jack, did I understand you to say the north-east point of the island?"
"Yes, Ribera, it is called. There is a tall cross on top of the headland, as I hope we shall see in an hour or two."
"Yet I had supposed that if we were lucky enough to find St. Michael's at all, a mere speck in the vast breadth of ocean, that we should run down its western side, so as to reach a point midway between St. Michael's and St. Mary, though somewhat to windward."
"That is the point we aim at, to be sure, but we must reach it from the east, as though we were sailing from Cadiz. My idea is to run down to 37 degrees 30 minutes north, or a little beyond, and then, avoiding the Formigas, to turn westwards, slowly beating up as though we were going to touch at Horta, in the hope that the Spartan will be waiting for us, or rather for the Athul."
"How do you estimate our chances at present?"
"Almost everything depends on the south wind that headed us on Tuesday. If it was blowing down there, and not so hard as to make Athul lie to, then it would have hurried her westward, and we shall be too late. But if it did not blow here, or if it had a great deal of west in it coming off the islands, then we may still find the Spartan waiting. But whether or no, you will still see St. Michael's, and if we skirt the little low islands and reefs of the Formigas, you may find some prodigious curious seaweeds and creatures. Tell me, Stephen," he began after a pause, and he was going to continue, "do you ever feel that what you are doing is not quite real? That you are playing a part, and that what seems to be the present don't really signify? Is it quite usual, or is it something unhealthy, the beginning of losing your mind?"
But it occurred to him that this might be too nearly related to complaint, and he substituted,
"How is your Padine coming along?"
"His face is pitifully swollen still, but he has a power of fortitude." "Could you do with another flying fish, sir?" asked Killick. "They are coming aboard in coveys."
Throughout the forenoon watch, when they were not trimming sails or going through the great gun exercise in dumb show, the greater part of the ship's company gazed at St. Michael's, steadily coming nearer, clearer, and now by noon, right on the beam, the tall cross on the headland stood sharp against the sky. The breeze had backed into the west. At the same time it had slackened, so that the last heave of the log gave only 5 knots, but this caused no despondency, because the midday observation, and the report was openly listened to without the least disguise, showed that they had run 210 miles between noon and noon. Once again the general cheer, and once again Padine did not hear it, being right down in the orlop locking away the laudanum, topped up to an even greater extent than before.
"After dinner we must think of rigging the mizzenmast bark fashion," said Jack to the officer of the watch. "Mr. Bulkley has been turning it over in his mind, and he has laid the cordage aside together with the blocks,
I do not believe it will take very long."
There was also the main t'gallant mast to be changed, and as soon as dinner was over the work of rousing out the necessary spars began, a tedious business, since the boats, which were stowed upon them, first had to be got over the side, slung from the main and the foreyards. Stephen and Martin, who had a singular genius for getting in the way during manoeuvres of this kind, but who were unwilling to go below on such a day, particularly with so many cliff-nesting birds about, took their mats and fishing-lines into the forecastle.
"How very much slower we are going," observed Martin.
"I made the same remark to the captain," said Stephen, "but he urged me not to fret. It was only because we were in the lee of the island. In an hour or so we shall be spinning along as merrily as ever."
By the time the gig, pinnace, and jolly-boat were towing astern, the Surprise had rounded Madrigada Point, and there, running before the wind in a course that would soon cross hers, was a gaily painted St. Michael's tunny-boat.
"Back the topsail," called Jack,
and the Surprise lost most of her way. The tunny boat altered course in answer to this obvious invitation.
"Pass the word for the doctor,"
and when he came,
"Doctor, I am sure you can speak the Portuguese."
"I am moderately fluent," said Stephen.
"Then be pleased to buy some fish, if they have any,"
said Jack,
"and then to ask them just what winds they have had here this week. You might ask for news of the Spartan, if you think proper, but it is the wind that really matters, above all the wind on Tuesday. Was it southerly, was it strong?"
The boat came alongside. Baskets of fish were handed up, silvery bonitos about 3 feet long, and pieces of money, counted loud and plain so that there should be no mistake, were handed down. Then followed a rambling conversation between Maturin and the boat, while West and Davidge had the launch and both cutters hoisted out and lowered down. Jack went below, and it was here that Stephen told him the bad news. The wind had blown hard from the south on Tuesday, and the tunny boat's uncle had seen a bark pass westwards yesterday as though from Cadiz for Fiol. Though it was true that the old gentleman had neither named nor described the vessel, apart from remarking that she wore Spanish colours.
"Well, well," said Jack, "it was but a very long shot at the best. Still, let us have a can of small beer to celebrate the fishes. There is nothing better than a steak of bonito grilled. Killick, Killick there! Let us have 2 cans of beer and a biscuit to help it down with."
The cool beer was not unpleasant at this time of day, and as they drank it, Jack observed,
"If I were a superstitious man, I should say that I had brought this on my own head by crowing so loud and hearty about yesterday's run, about making my landfall so exactly and in such uncommon good time."
"I never heard you crowing."
"No, but fate did. Believe me, Stephen, there is more in these feelings than old wives' tales and not walking under ladders. It seems to me that you have to treat destiny or fortune, or whatever is the right word, with a proper respect. A man must not bounce or presume, but he must not despair neither, for that is ill-bred. So although you may laugh in your sleeve, I mean to go through the motions of changing our rig and cruising between St. Michael's and St. Mary for the rest of the day. Then tomorrow, having done the thing handsomely, we can go home. And if you choose, we will go by the Formigas and land you there for half a tide."
The Surprise, now a pale blue-sided bark, worked slowly to windward between the two islands. By the middle of the first dog-watch she was in the position her captain had laid down as ideal. But no Spartan did she see. Nor was there any expectation of seeing her, since many of the hands could at least follow some Portuguese. Their combined knowledge had led them to an accurate conclusion, and it said a great deal for their respect for Jack Aubrey that the change in the frigate's rig had been carried out with such accuracy and speed, and that there was no slackness or murmuring at the present standing off and on. A wearisome series of turns, slower, much longer, but not altogether unlike those of her captain, as he paced out his mile after mile between the taffrail and a certain ring-bolt just abaft the gangway. A ring-bolt that his turning heel had long since polished to a silvery brightness. This evening there was no beating to quarters, and in such cases the last dog-watch was usually a time of music and dancing on the forecastle, but today the hands sat about in the warmth of the evening, talking quietly. The sun set, leaving rosy light behind it for a while. Hammocks were piped down, the watch was set, and the ship settled into her routine for the night, moving slowly north and south under reefed topsails and drawing her boats after her. According to the letter of his private law, Jack Aubrey should have had them hoisted in. But as all the changes of this afternoon were to be reversed tomorrow for the homeward voyage, and as the tired, dispirited men would have the heavy, useless labour twice over, he left things as they were. Sitting at his desk in the great cabin, he began a new sheet in a serial letter that he wrote to Sophie, a kind of private journal that she was to share.
"Here we are, my dearest Sophie, south of St. Michael's in a sea as warm as milk. How I hope your weather is half as kind as ours. If it is, the yellow rose on the south wall will be blowing finely. I hope to see it in a week or so, for we turn back tomorrow. Our voyage has not been quite as fortunate as I had hoped, but as I told you, we have won quite handsome little prize in the Merlin, and the new hands are shaping uncommonly well. Stephen says he has rarely seen a healthier crew, not a man in his list except for poor Padine with the faceache, and this he puts down to their having very little to eat and nothing but small beer to drink. At the moment he and Mr. Martin are in the boats towing astern, fishing for luminous insects with little hand nets and strainers. And I must confess—"
Here his letter broke off, for he heard something so like gunfire that he put down his pen. In another moment it was repeated, and he ran up on deck. Davidge and West were leaning their telescopes on the larboard rail.
"Right on the beam, sir," said West. "There they go again."
And clear under the darkness of the eastern sky, Jack saw the gun flashes, widely separated.
"They're 10 miles away," said Davidge, when the sound reached them at last. "And at least half a mile apart," said West.
A long pause while they studied the eastern horizon with the most extreme intensity, a pause during which the left-hand gun fired twice, and that on the right, the southern gun, 3 times.
"Mr. Davidge, put the ship before the wind," said Jack.
"Shall I hoist in the boat, sir?" asked Davidge.
"Not yet, but pray get the doctor aboard," said Jack,
hurrying below for his glass. The ship turned slowly on the gentle breeze, steadying with her head due east, and from the foreyard he commanded a vast expanse of sea. It had been fairly clear before, and it was perfectly certain now, that what he had in his night glass was a running fight between 2 ships, the pursuer about 1/2 mile behind and in the other's wake, and both firing most deliberately with their chasers, 2 bow chasers on the one hand and 2 stern chasers on the other, perhaps with a 3rd on her quarter-deck. The moon would not be up for some hours, but there was still a fair amount of diffused light from the zenith, and catching the gun flash with the utmost accuracy of focus, he established that the leading ship was a bark. The flash of the quarter-deck gun, and there was indeed a gun mounted on her quarter-deck, lit her spanker and showed the utter absence of a mizzen topsail. He checked this twice, and called,
"Deck! On deck there! All hands to make sail!"
These might very well be 2 national ships, French and British, American and British, French and Spanish, and his intimate conviction that the chase was the Athul and the chaser the Spartan might be born of nothing but an urgent wish that it should be so. Yet the bark rig for a man of war was virtually unknown in the Royal Navy, and very rare in any of the others, and in any event, if he was wrong, it cost no more than 1 night's rest. Below him the boatswain's calls howled and wailed, and he could hear the cries of, "Tumble up, tumble up, tumble up, rouse out there, you sleepers!" He came down from the yard and took over the deck. He knew very exactly what the Surprise liked in this wind, the only wind in which her present want of a mizzen topsail was no disadvantage to her, and presently she was running directly before it with spritsail, foresail with stunsails on either side, main topsail and topgallant, both with their stunsails, and a main royal above all.
"And the boats, sir?" asked Davidge anxiously. "Do you wish to have them hoisted in?"
"No. With the wind right aft it would lose us more time than it would save. You have the doctor aboard, however, I see. Doctor, should you like to come into the foretop and see what is afoot? Bondon, give the doctor a hand, and bring me my come-up glass in its case."
With the foretopsail furled, the foretop gave a perfect view. Jack said,
"There! Did you catch it? She has no mizzen topsail. That means she is a bark, because with the wind on her beam, or just abaft of it, she would certainly spread her mizzen topsail if she had one. It stands to reason. Shall I tell you what I think has happened, always supposing my wild guess is right?"
"If you please."
I believe the Athul did lie, too, on that Tuesday, that the Spartan sailed east to look for her, steering rather more to the north than was quite right, and that they came in sight of one another late this afternoon. The Athul bore up and ran for it on what I suppose is her best point of sailing, but the Spartan has the legs of her and came within range a little while ago. Since then they have been firing their chasers pretty steady in the hope of knocking something away.
What is the likely event, do you suppose?
If the Athul does not manage to knock something away, the Spartan will overhaul her and then their broadside will come into play. Then everything will depend on their gunnery. But if the Spartan can get close enough without losing any important spar, her 42-pounder carronades must knock the stuffing out of the bark, no question about it.
We are not to be idle spectators, sure?
I hope not, indeed. I doubt we can come up with them before the Spartan, for so I call her, overhauls the Athul, because we are directly before the wind, a poor point of sailing for any ship, even the Surprise. But with any sort of luck we should engage her not long after, for, do you see, as they move south and we follow them, so we bring the breeze more on our quarter, and may spread more canvas. We may engage her, and we may take her.
A pause.
I am glad we did not change our long guns for carronades, however, as I had once thought of doing. I had much rather pepper her from a distance than come close to her 42-pound smashers. If we have to chase, I shall cast off the boats with Bondon and a few good hands in the pinnace. But of course, you know, there are 100 possibilities. The Athul may haul her wind, cross the Spartan's hawse, rake her and board her in the smoke. 100 things may happen.
Now they fell silent,
as did all the hands crowding the forecastle below them, watching the distant battle as it moved slowly across the western sea, in a night all the blacker for the flashes of the guns. Once the pursuer yawed to let fly with a full broadside, and the brilliant glare showed that she was ship-rigged. "The Spartan for 100 pound," muttered Jack.
"What is a come-up glass?" asked Stephen.
"Oh," said Jack absently. "It has a lens halfway along, divided into two, so that it gives you two images. When they separate, the ship is moving from you. When they overlap, she is coming nearer."
An hour and a half went by, and slowly, slowly the pursuer made up the distance lost by her yaw, and then began to gain. Now she was firing her forward guns, and now, from the Surprise, they were only halfway to the horizon. The crash and rumbling echo of the gunfire grew almost continuous as the two came more nearly alongside, and the smoke rolled away in a solid cloud just aft of the Athul. For Athul she was. In the blaze of the Spartan's full broadside, a long and rippling broadside, Jack caught her pale sides full in his glass. The Spartan was half a mile to windward and edging closer when all at once the Athul seemed to put her helm hard over, turning with extraordinary speed as though to run before the wind and then coming up part of the way on the other tack. The Spartan at once raked her exposed stern, but it seemed to Jack that the range was too great for the carronades to do much execution. Nor was the Spartan handled nearly as well as he had expected from their last encounter. She ran on an unconscionable time before her sails were trimmed to carry her after the Athul.
"Perhaps the bark will run clear," said Jack, half aloud. "Perhaps the Spartan has lost a spar."
But something was wrong. The Athul did not seem to be running at all. He fixed her with his come-up glass. The image was steady. She was motionless. What is more, lights were running about her deck, and although the Spartan was at last bearing down, the Athul was lowering a boat. Two boats.
"By God!" cried Jack. "She has struck on the Formigas!"
All this time the chase had been drawing southward, and he had altered sail accordingly. Now he reduced it to fore and main courses alone, the most inconspicuous the frigate could wear, and altered course half a point. Standing there, with his hands hard clenched on the top rim, he watched the continuing battle, closer now by far. The moon rose, lighting the great swaths of white smoke, and to his astonishment he saw the Spartan move right in to grapple and board on the far side of the Athul, the starboard side, away from the Surprise. He raced down on deck, ordered the arms chests to be brought up and the few remaining lights to be doused. Then he ran forward into the bows.
Far over the water the gunfire reached its height, 3 full thundering broadsides from either ship, the last 2 almost simultaneous, then 1 or 2 guns, some musket and pistol shots, then silence. And Jack could see men jumping from the Athul's lit gun ports into the boats on her larboard side. He saw them pull clear, apparently hidden from the Spartans' view. Back on the quarterdeck, he raised his voice and called,
"All hands aft!"
When the men had gathered, he said,
"Shipmates, the Athul has struck on the Formigas. The Spartan is grappled fast alongside. We are going to take her and her prize in the boats. Mr. West, the armourer, will serve out pistols, cutlasses, or boarding axes according to choice. I shall lead the way in the launch, followed by Mr. Smith in the blue cutter and Mr. Bulkley in the red, and we board the Athul, mind, at the forechains. Mr. Davidge takes the pinnace, Mr. Bentley the gig, and Mr. Kane the jolly boat, and they board the Athul at the mizzen chains. The boats keep together with a line stem to stern. We board the Athul, we cross her deck, remember Nelson's Bridge, and we tackle the Spartans, taking them from the front and the rear. Not a sound as we approach, but sing out as you go aboard, and once aboard the watchword is surprise. Now," raising his voice at the first murmur, "not a cheer, not a sound until we are there. Mr. West, I am grieved to say you must stay in the ship with 10 men, and move in when I signal with 3 lanterns, but no nearer than half a mile. We proceed in 5 minutes' time."
He stepped below for his sword and pistols, wrote orders for West in case he should be knocked on the head or the expedition should end in disaster, and so made his way down into the launch. The darkness was filled with whispering, and this accentuated the extraordinary feeling of eagerness that he felt all around him. He had known many a cutting-out expedition, but never one with quite such a degree of fierce anticipation. Though fierce was not quite the word.
"Ready?"
he called softly to each boat in turn, and each replied,
"Ready, aye, ready, sir."
"Give way," he said.
There was an easy southern swell. The breeze was with them, and the boats pulled fast across the water with never a sound but the creak of thwarts and thole pins and the gurgle of oars. Nearer, nearer, and nearer still, the boats keeping close together. In the last 100 yards, Jack was almost certain that a blast of grape was going to come from the Athul's well-lit gun deck, where men could be seen walking about. He leaned forward and said in a low voice,
"Stretch out now! Stretch out for Doggett's coat and badge!"
He loosened his sword, and as Bondon brought the launch smoothly under the Athul's forechains, he sprang into them, up over the rail, leaping with a tremendous shout onto the forecastle, empty but for 3 bodies. Instantly he was urged on by the jostling crowd of men pushing after him, and at the same time he heard the bellowing cheer of the other division coming aboard, and the roar of "Surprise! Surprise!" Some horrified faces stared up from the 3 bright hatchways and instantly bobbed down out of sight.
"Come on, come on! Bear a hand there!" cried Jack,
racing along the gangway and over the grapplings into the Spartan. The attack was wholly, utterly unexpected. But 25 or 30 Spartans opposed them on the quarterdeck, a close-packed, resolute body with what arms they had had time to snatch up. A musket shot dashed Jack's sword from his hand, a pike thrust furrowed the side of his neck, and a short, thick, heavy man butted him under the chin, knocking him back onto a corpse. He writhed sideways, pistoled the thick man, caught up a heavy piece of the shattered rail 6 feet long, and flung himself at the group, beating with frightful strength. They fell back, hampering one another, and instantly he struck a great, scything blow that brought 3 of them down. He was about to strike again, backhanded, when Davidge caught his arm, shouting,
"Sir! Sir! They have surrendered, sir!"
"Have they?"
said Jack, breathing heavily, his face losing its pale, almost maniac fury.
"So much the better! Belay! Vast fighting there!"
This directed to a scuffle on the forecastle. He threw down his weapon. It was like a great oak door jamb, and said,
"Where is their captain?"
"Dead, sir," said Davidge. "Killed by the Athul. Here is the only officer left."
"Do you answer for your men, sir?"
said Jack to the white-faced young man before him.
"Yes, sir."
"Then they must go down into the hold directly, except for the wounded. Where are the Athul's people?"
"They went off in their boats, sir, before we boarded her. There were not many left."
"Mr. Davidge, 3 lanterns from the gun deck, if you please, to be slung in the shrouds."
The lanterns lit up a scene of great destruction. The Athul's gunnery must have been strikingly accurate, and the Spartan's heavy metal at close range could not but smash whatever it touched. The death toll must necessarily be very high, above all between decks, but from what he could see as he strode among the bodies, none of his men had been killed, though Webster was bent, gasping over a wound in his belly, and his mates were putting the gunner's bloody arm in a sling.
"Sir," said the young man, "may I beg you to cast off the bark? She cannot float another 5 minutes. We were only waiting until we had the last of the quicksilver out of her."
"I am so sorry you missed it, Tom," said Jack Aubrey, breakfasting in his cabin with Pullings, who, true to his rendezvous, had appeared shortly after the rise of the sun. "It was the prettiest little surprise you can imagine, and there was no other way of doing it, for I was certainly not going to take the ship in among those shoals at night. Most horrible rocks. The Athul went down in 10 fathom water very shortly after we had taken her wounded out. How that young fool ever came alongside her unhurt, I shall never comprehend."
"But I am sorry you should have been hurt, sir," said Pullings. "I only hope it is not as bad as it looks."
"No, no, it is a trifle. The doctor himself says it is a trifle, and I never felt it at the time. A pike thrust, a glancing pike thrust. We suffered very little. But God's my life, how they did maul one another, Spartan and Athul. As bloody a little engagement as ever I saw. The gun decks of both were a swim with blood, a swim. There were only 2 boatloads of Athuls left capable of walking, and I don't think we took over 20 Spartans apart from the wounded. It is true they had sent a great many men away in their 5 big prizes, yet even so it was a most shocking butchery."
"Here is the bo'sun, sir," said Killick.
"Sit down, Mr. Bulkley," said Jack. "What I wished to ask you was, have we plenty of French colours?"
"Not above 3 or 4, I believe, sir."
"Then you might consider making a few more. I do not say you are to make a few more, Mr. Bulkley, for that might be coming at a trifle too high. I only say that you might bear it in mind."
"Aye, aye, sir. Bore in mind it is," said the boatswain, taking his leave.
"Now, Tom," said Jack, "returning to the prizes, there is not a minute to be lost. The doctor will curse, I know," nodding through the stern window to an islet upon which Stephen and Martin were creeping on all fours, having left the wounded to their respective surgeons. "But as soon as the Spartan is in a state to make sail, and she is very well found in cordage and stores of every kind, we must bear away for Fayal as fast as ever we can pelt, cracking on to make all sneer again, because the end of the month and the Constitution are coming closer every day. We must bear away for Fayal. The Spartan's 5 prizes are lying there in Horta Harbour. The Spartan appears in the offing, accompanied by something that looks very like the Athul. Of course, the Spartan don't choose to come down that long bay and lose time clawing out, but the Merlin they know so well, stands in, gives them a couple of guns, and the signal for departure. They slip their cables and join us well out at sea, where we remove the prize crews and carry the prizes home, hoisting French colours aboard each one to fox the Constitution if she should heave in sight. Do you take my meaning, Tom?"